Welcome to the arena. My name is Greg Sindelar, and we are here at Texas Policy Summit with the one, the only, Senator Brandon Creighton. Senator Creighton, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, it's good to be here with you.
How's everything going? We're past the primaries. The election season's kind of starting to tail off a little bit. How are things going back home in your district?
It's been great. It's been quite an experience after a full year last year in the most consecutive days.
No
breaks, right? So many days in session and with work for the legislature to address pressing issues since 1871, right? So
yeah.
We're home reconnecting and explaining the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I call it my "What Were You Thinking?" tour.
So what are the things that constituents are most curious about? What were you thinking?
You know, our constituents are all over the different subjects you could imagine on what's important to each and every individual. Obviously, the border is a huge subject on the minds of Senate District 4 constituents, and I like to tell people I have 1.1 million head coaches and I'm the team, right?
There you go.
So we have so much, diversity of opinion on how to solve problems and pressing issues of the day. Education, of course, property tax reform and relief. Just a vision for Texas, where we're headed to solve the major problems related to big infrastructure for long-term water planning, the grid, the electric grid is always top of mind in conversation. And so it's an incredible opportunity to represent Southeast Texas, and I'm partial to those that I represent. It's something else to be in front of those audiences too. It is a surgical line of questioning on exactly what we're doing here and how we arrived at certain conclusions.
Yeah, you can't be an inch deep because people ask very, very specific questions about legislation. Yeah, it's gonna be difficult.
They really do. Consultants always told me not to get into process, is boring to the audience and not much interest there. That is just absolutely not the case. The Texans are, and especially those I represent, just firsthand experience, they're very involved with and knowledgeable about the founder's intent, the process itself, and the breakdowns, and social media enhances that, right?
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Yeah. Well, I want to get more into some of those subject areas, but let's take maybe a little bit of a step back. And so you're a native son of your district.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about, give us a little bit of background, our audience a little bit of background about you, but also kind of how you got into this world, because you've been in and around this for quite a long time.
Yeah, my life flashes before me in retrospect every time. It's January of an odd numbered year, right? And it just seems like it goes really fast. And our time that we spent over four sessions in the House, and now it's been the equivalent amount of time in the Senate, and it's just been very interesting. But yes, I'm from Conroe, Montgomery County, longtime family there, eight generations. My family have been there, and my son and my daughter are ninth. And it's one of the fastest growing counties in the nation, right? So it's not the Conroe's not the sleepy little town that I'm from, as far as growing up. It is a totally different place.
Yeah.
But it's an incredible snapshot of the pulse and the heart of the entire state. Just as we've seen over the past several years in politics and outcomes of elections with Beto and Abbott as a great example, Texas has never been more diverse, and it's certainly, in my opinion, not been more conservative.
Yeah.
And you don't hear that in the manufactured media narratives. You don't really hear that's possible or a reality, but I see that right there at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up on a ranch right outside of the city of Conroe, and my family ranched there and in just outside of Las Cruces, New Mexico. Most of my life growing up, we were running horses back and forth, and irrigating that ranch in New Mexico with windmills and running cows on both properties. And you learn a lot of just true grit and fortitude when
you're a 24/7 hour,
right?
24 hours, 7 day a week job.
It was like, you know, a much much less accomplished, you know, Yellowstone kind of lifestyle, but Texas style, you know, growing up. And it just no better place to.
What was the name of your ranch?
To grow up, Plum Out of Luck.
Oh, that's a good one.
The POL.
Yeah. I could see a Taylor Sheridan movie about that.
I could see the same, and the cinematography and the landscape would have been excellent for.
Yeah, that's right.
For both locations. So, yeah. But it was you know, a lot of hauling hay in the summers and a lot of work. My dad always had a list for myself and my brothers, and mysteriously, you know, we could never finish that list and go do other things for fun. But he always said, as soon as your list is done, you can go do whatever you want.
Yeah, that list was a living document just grew.
Absolutely. He had it down to a science on knowing somehow exactly how tired we would be and how late it would be when we were finished. And we didn't quite figure that out soon enough.
Yeah, kept you out of trouble, though, I bet.
Kept us out of trouble, and it kept us honest. And, you know, it was a great way to grow up. And then, worked at a chemical plant as a pipe fitter. When I got out of high school, my dad wanted me to develop a trade and a skill.
Yeah.
Something that can never be taken away from me. But that was not a fork in the road for me on college or a trade. It was a road.
Yeah.
And so after that year, I found the largest air-conditioned building I could find, which was this Texas State Capitol. And I got rid of the hard hat and the fireproof coveralls. And I worked as a messenger and a policy aide in the Senate while I was in college working my way through school.
Yeah. And are you either one of the few, or were you the first person to be a Senate messenger to become a Texas senator?
Yes. Patsy Spall did the research on that when I was sworn in, and I did not realize that. Apparently there had been another messenger or two from the Senate that had been a House member, but never in the Texas Senate. So, yes, I was proud of that. I had some really good friends that were messengers with me at that time in college that are still, you know, in different capacities around Austin today. I'll call them out, but Jay McCart and Eric Wright and Brad Canepa, a few of my close friends, we were just walking around the building in awe of the personalities that were there at the time. I'll date myself, but it was when Bullock was lieutenant governor.
Okay, yeah.
And Governor Bill Clements was leaving, and Ann Richards was coming in. It was a long time ago.
Very formative time that kind of led to a lot of changes
in
Texas history. But you know, so you finish school, and then tell me about what happens after you get out of college.
Yeah, so I had worked in the Senate, and then the senator that I was working for lost his reelection effort, so I moved over to the Attorney General's office and worked as an investigator in the Child Support Division.
Okay.
Worked there for about a year, and I knew I wanted to go to law school, but I needed a night school because I was paying my own way through, right?
Yeah.
So, and I needed it to be commutable. So I ended up at Oklahoma's SMU. It's their private Methodist school, Oklahoma City University.
Yeah.
It's really close to the state capitol. I knew I could probably get a job there because I had been at the Texas Capitol.
And
that's what I ended up doing. I worked in the criminal appellate division of the Oklahoma Attorney General's office as a brief writer. And it was Governor Frank Keating was there at the time, and Bob Dole was running for president.
Yeah.
I worked on that on campus. And,
did you really?
And just really enjoyed all of that experience and, you know, just driving back and forth, selling land on the weekends in Houston and just trying to survive.
But that's very formative, right? And it probably is what, besides your story growing up, like made you so gritty, and I think probably prepared you well for what you then did in the legislature. So, you know, obviously you have a very unique perspective. You served, you know, as you said, four terms in the House, four sessions in the House. You've now done four in the Senate. You know, can you talk a little bit about the differences you see between each chamber, like the pros and cons from your perspective?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just really enjoyed my time in the House. I have great respect for the House and the House members. It's a very different experience than in the Senate. And I remind my Senate colleagues of that often on frustrating days. But I enjoyed my time in the House so much that I requested to be sworn into the Senate in the House chamber.
Oh, really?
Governor Rick Perry, was sort of the MC of the deal and handled the actual swearing in himself. And I had a lot of constituents come over, and I just really enjoyed my time there. I served as Republican caucus chairman for 104 members, which was the largest Republican caucus in the nation of any state legislature at the time. Yeah. We're building our way back to those numbers now, right?
Yeah.
I always tell people at home the Senate, and just comparing the House and the Senate from one from the other, the Senate is your family reunion in the first 30 minutes that you show up, where everybody's on great behavior. You know, the House is your family reunion 30 minutes before everybody leaves, right? It's rough and tumble, and you're reminding your cousins of how they, you know, wronged you whenever you were teenagers, and you're just kind of hashing it out. And it's been it's just great to see the comparison of the two. And by design, our founders, as we all know, were so brilliant in the process that they set up. But the House is emotional and accountable to the people in a way that is just unparalleled, in the fact that they have to go right home, run for reelection, and explain themselves, right?
Yep.
And that, by its very nature and the number of those House members, it creates a incredible pressure cooker, mm-hmm. where in the Senate, with a four-year term, we have sometimes a tomorrow attitude because the urgency isn't as great, even though I'm very proud of what the Senate's been producing lately. Yeah. We're feeling the voice of Texas and certainly the grassroots and their pulse, I think, in an incredible way right now. And the chemistry in the Senate among the members is, I think, a collective effort of what I would call in the business world producers.
Yeah.
There are just a incredible assembly of very good and genuine, hardworking, well-intentioned people that are just incredibly capable, and I'm proud to work with all of them. Yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah. So let's get a little on the policy, because now you're chair of education, so you're kind of handling K through 12 and higher ed along with the other members of your committee.
Yes.
Can you take us a little through, you know, last session? Obviously, you know, you guys passed school choice and a lot of education bills, the curriculum accountability bill. I know priority of yours. You did school choice several times. You passed banning DEI, you passed tenure reform. Can you kind of talk about, one, how you have the time for all of that, and two, how that process worked and how you worked that through to get those all to completion? I know school choice isn't there yet. It ran into roadblocks in the House, but, you know, the governor was here yesterday, is very bullish on the chances next session.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. I mean, intersection of time and opportunity certainly came together with Lieutenant Governor Patrick asking me to serve as the Senate Education Chair in a combined committee, construct, right? Where in years past, the Higher Education Committee that I was chairing with a workforce component was separate. The K through 12 committee for Senate education was its own committee. And then I would add a third element on Senate finance. I'm the Article 3 chairman over the way the dollars flow. So you have the policy and the dollars. And those are sometimes in the Senate, three different individuals. And our office is handling sort of at the helm on all three. So, but how do we handle it? How do I handle it? 100% credit to my team. Mm-hmm. Our office, in my opinion, is the best in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. I ask way too much of each of them, and but our door
you're
is
just challenging them.
Absolutely,
you're
right.
Growing them.
They're challenging me.
Yeah, that's right.
I guarantee you, they keep me constantly challenged, and they're just very bright, capable individuals, and I'm proud of them. So. It's a third of the bill load, and we spend an incredible amount of time in hearings. It's a hot rock at the end of session in May because there's so much expectation.
Yeah.
And we still have all of the House bills coming over, and our floor time, which you mentioned, just the emergency item, school choice alone, we passed several times. The DEI and our higher education reform package, DEI alone within that package was an 8-hour debate.
Yep.
Tenure.
Do you have comfortable shoes when you're doing that?
Comfortable shoes, right? I noticed in some of the video clips that I was at the end of that debate standing and hanging on to my chair.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not surprised at that, but
no.
I don't mind standing a long time. No restroom breaks, that was okay.
Yeah.
It's no snacks, you know, that's what gets to me, right? I'm a constant snacker.
You're not getting a little hangry at the end of it,
are you? Right. I mean, I was thinking, you know, my chief Tara might lob me a package of Oreos or something from the brass rail, but I don't think Miss Ball would appreciate that. So we stayed within the rules, but it's a privilege to handle any and all of it. It's a heavy load. I ran towards danger on asking for the education role and. As a rookie education chair for K-12 and working with Brad Buckley as a rookie education chair in the House, I believe that history will show soon that we accomplished some incredible things in education. All of the oxygen in the room is focused on school choice, and I agree with the governor. I think we will get there to the finish line, and we will get there soon, maybe with a better bill.
Yeah.
The curriculum reform and many of the things that we did for our parental bill of rights and our teacher bill of rights to get those conversations going, get those bills out of the Senate. I think not just moms and dads across the state were paying attention to that, but we're seeing other states already model them. Governor DeSantis announced an effort to model our teacher bill of rights soon after we filed it. And at our conferences, legislators are telling me that, as usual, Texas is out front, and they have great respect for what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, and another bill, I know they're kind of run at the same time. I saw a speech of Governor DeSantis where he was like, you know, Texas might pass their banning DEI bill before we do. And we ended up passing it just after theirs. But, obviously it's a really great bill. You ran that bill. Can you talk a little bit about the purpose of that bill? And, you know, sometimes when people are talking about DEI, they're like, well, it's just trying to create inclusion in the university, right? Like, we're sitting here at the University of Texas right now. You know, I would argue that DEI doesn't do that, but I'm curious your perspective on the importance of that bill and what it means for our institutes of higher education.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I was somewhat mocked and ridiculed for bringing that bill forward at the beginning. Are you sure a guy that looks like you wants to have a conversation on the Senate floor about this subject,
yep.
including racism, in the year 2023? And you must be certifiable in doing so. But it was—I
might say courageous.
it was much,
maybe a little both, right?
it was much big. Yes, I mean, I hope that at the end of the day, it will show. I know it will show that we weren't only on the right track, but that. That we will accomplish the opposite of what was going on, which is we'll find diverse outcomes, but we will also prevent the weaponization of those what those DEI units were essentially doing, which was they were hurting other vulnerable and minority populations on campus. And the minority faculty recruitment data, the statistics, we weren't using manufactured leftist Marxist fake news narratives.
Yeah.
We were using data, right? Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
To rely on the facts. And the facts showed that 10 years under DEI, minority faculty recruitment and hiring went backwards.
Yep.
That A&M had excluded Asian American students from DEI strategies. Texas Tech professors were being terminated for simply pledging to treat every student equally. You know, those are just a couple of examples, and we had 8 hours of examples and discussion on the Senate floor. So I think the opposition was shocked at our opening statement of 45 minutes out of the 8 hours, all the way to closing, because we did not talk about a lot of those examples in the committee hearing with Dr. Ben Carson as my lead witness and many other incredible witnesses. We saved some of that for the Senate floor discussion. And I mean, all of Texas was talking about it. So it's always difficult when you take nomenclature like that and you announce that you're removing it. But there was much more going on there than just the title. And I went to Tallahassee to see Governor DeSantis and his education team before our session. I would say that looking at the details and the actual verbiage of their bill compared to ours, not only is it important to talk about the sequence of which passed first, but our bill is much, much stronger. So
I was going to say that, but I was going to let you have that.
thanks for the softball there. Yeah. But they have a really good caption and a directive from the governor's office, which is very strong. But our clawback provisions on funding, if universities fail to comply, I would be surprised if another state in the country passes a bill with that kind of language.
Yeah, you know, and yesterday we had a panel here about that, and your colleague, Senator Betancourt, was talking specifically about that. And he said, I look forward to talking to some of these universities and their and looking at their budgets as we see how they're implementing the bill.
Yes, I mean, we're looking very closely at the HRIs, the health-related institutions, right? And there's a disconnect, especially in medical school curriculum on in our opinion and the committee's opinion on, in taking this bill seriously. And I think that there needs to be some house cleaning very, very quickly by some of these institutions before we get to public hearings. And we've sent letters, we've made phone calls, we've made it very clear, but the culture of these universities, it's so deeply rooted that at a national conference on DEI and the damaging effects of DEI in North Carolina last year, they said the only state that where DEI in the nation was so deeply rooted that it would take a nuclear bomb to get rid of it was Texas. And they're
just,
you know,
shocking.
That was at a conference in North Carolina, right? So I think there are some games being played on relaunching, renaming, and sort of authorizing the same types of conduct and mission under different, under different titles or names, and that's going to be a mistake if that's any of these institutions, you know, end goal.
Yeah. The governor said yesterday he knows there's scofflaws and they're paying attention and the legislature is paying attention. Well, so obviously, you know, I think you make a good point. It's so deeply rooted. And as you know, I talked to our team about it. It's like these are generational battles that we're working on, right? But coming up into the 89th session next year, what are you seeing on the K through 12, but especially higher ed front that you think is the next battles that we'll be waging?
Yeah, so we've passed so many good bills over the past couple of sessions that monitoring those bills for consequences, for compliance, and for any sort of evolving changes that are necessary, that's a huge part of what we'll be doing. The high-quality instruction material curriculum for K through 12 that Chairman Buckley and I carried together, we will be watching that closely as the SBOE is currently, the State Board of Education is developing the rubric for implementation of that curriculum and how that curriculum will ultimately be published and distributed, right? So we're watching that very closely. That I think that's going to be, again, a national model for how we make sure that the teaching methods and getting woke out of the classroom is sort of front and center on taking back our public schools. That is a demand from moms and dads watching closely through the COVID years, as they didn't just do homework with their kids, they did classroom instruction with their kids, and they learned so much that they were not pleased with through that hands-on experience that the legislature is responding. So CRT, DEI, budget efficiencies, conservative free speech, and just free speech protection on campuses, all in all, right? All of these things we will be focused on with some additional public ed reforms along with school choice, right? So that school choice bill is only getting bigger, bolder, faster, stronger. And sometimes when you don't take a deal, a very, very lucrative, good deal, right? And you don't have the acumen or understanding to know that it was a deal that's almost irreplaceable, you end up in a later session with a bill that you do not like and a lesser set of choices on deal points than you ever would have had.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where we're headed, including with the dollars.
Yeah, I was a couple weeks ago, I was in up in the Panhandle, in the rural, very rural part of the state, and I was meeting with a superintendent up there, and he said, "We know it's coming. I wish we would have taken the deal."
Yeah.
It's like, I wish we would have figured out how to get that done.
Well, I like your perspective on that. Just in these one-on-one conversations, I'm hearing the same. Yeah. And we're doing what, you know, Republicans haven't done very much of. We're going into the superintendent conferences, talking directly to large teacher groups and education organizations. Because, you know, over the years, they have just rejected our reforms, blasted us during elections, and haven't been as good faith dealers as they should be during the session. And so some of those conferences we stopped attending. I'm going to every one of them I can. And 350 superintendents at a time, I'm hearing what you heard, which is, how do we get back to and rewind where we, you know, are today, back to the table where we were last year to get this deal inked, because we should have taken it.
And
I'm afraid that ship has sailed, though.
I think you're right. But the other thing I keep telling these superintendents and these local folks, I go, listen, this isn't either or. This isn't, you know, no one's trying to destroy public education here, but this is ensuring that we are realizing the potential of every child in this state.
You know, it is the most egregious, ridiculous narrative on the street that school choice and 40 to 60,000 education savings accounts is anything but harmonious with lifting up public schools and public school teachers. And our education landscape in Texas, we shouldn't be 32nd in the nation to follow anyone, right? No Texan wants to hear that we're following, right? We should be leading, and for 90% of that weighted framework for those education savings accounts to serve special needs and free and reduced lunch kids. And those kids are often the last mentioned when these institution mindsets come in to say that this is something that's going to tear down the sticks and bricks of public schools themselves. It's absurd. And for our smartest teachers out there and superintendents to fall into that kind of narrative, I just think is not just something that makes me angry. It's sad. It's tragic. And we're all in it together to make sure that we are working on school to a job for generational change for these families, not school to prison. And it is not much in between for many of these communities. So I'm very proud of the work that we've done, and I'm proud of the partners that I've had in the House on this. And for those that did not partner with us, if they come back and survive their reelection effort, I hope that they would be much more willing to be open-minded on where we're headed.
Door is always open to do the right thing.
Yeah,
right?
Our door is always open. The door is completely open to do the right thing, and we need to drop these divisive labels and these intents to separate all of us for nefarious types of goals and interests, and just say, what are we here for?
Yep.
If we don't leave a legacy as elected officials for providing a better education outcome for these kids in tragic situations, I have no idea why we ever originally ran for office in the first place.
Yeah, 100%. Amen. Well, last question, because you're a busy guy, and I want to be respectful of your time. Most important question. If I'm in your district, what's the best place that I should eat?
Oh, man.
I told you I was going to give you one hard question.
and I was wondering if this was a hot seat, right? I would say that a restaurant in Conroe called Vernon's.
Vernon's,
it's called Vernon's Country Catfish. Years ago, they used to cater on the Capitol grounds when the original owner, who's passed now, the family still owns it. And have always been very generous with their community efforts, but not just the food, but I would say growing up as a kid and my experiences after church going there with my extended family members that are not alive anymore, and the memories that I have of being in that restaurant with all of them and how good it is today, how good it was then. With apologies to all my other favorite restaurants in the district, because we have the best food, not in Texas, I would say in the country.
Yeah.
So that's an impossible question to answer. But because of the nostalgia and the food together, I would say Vernon's Country Catfish, Country Catfish spelt with two K's.
Okay. Country Catfish with two K's.
Yeah.
Well, next time I'm up there, I look forward to going that. Maybe we'll meet you there for lunch or something.
Let's do it.
Well, Senator Creighton, appreciate so much your leadership on so many issues, but especially on education issues, higher education issues. You've been such a stalwart for many years. And, you know, this show's called The Arena, and it's meant to thank those of you who are in the arena, like, doing this. Like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was right. Like, it's kind of thankless sometimes, but we do appreciate all the work that you're doing. And I appreciate you joining us today and being here with us, and congratulations on a successful session last session, and Godspeed on an upcoming session. Hopefully it goes really well for you.
Appreciate the hospitality. It's always great to be with you, and look forward to continuing to work with you on some of these victories that we will most certainly accomplish very soon together.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, thank you for everyone for joining us on this episode of The Arena with wonderful Senator Brandon Creighton. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.